Please stay tuned.
A boutique and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on promoting the earth, then telling where we gonna plant our seed. It makes me wanna cry for the children. Makes me wanna.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Welcome. Glad you can join us for Ecologic. Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. This is Ecologic for Wednesday, February 28th, 2024.
We want to welcome listeners whom I met at yesterday's rally protesting the insurance industry's support of the fossil fuel industry. Can you believe that? When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said. Our guest today is Brian Solem from Slow Food USA. But first, we'll talk about artificial turf, lithium mining, right to repair news, and a proposal by National Grid to raise rates again.
A couple of weeks ago, a listener asked us about artificial turf. Early in the 1990s, the EPA saw a lot of old tires piling up and supported what was then a novel solution. Recycle them as the main part of artificial turf. However, it is clear that the old tires are full of toxic chemicals, and some 30 years later, very few professional teams are still using artificial turf, and we are less sure that it is a good idea. Last year, The Guardian and others pointed to the death of six Phillies ballplayers from glioblastoma, a rare form of cancer, and wondered if the artificial turf on which they had played for most of their careers was the culprit. Of course, one of the issues with making such a determination is that there's no marker that clearly states the source of a cancer, and it generally takes years to develop. Dr. Helen Caldicott explained the latency of cancer by comparing it to the latency of the common cold. If someone sneezes on you and gives you their cold, you don't get it instantly, but the next morning or the day after that. That's what latency is. Cancer's latency is usually measured in years, not days. Nonetheless, some towns are looking to change their park ball fields to from grass to artificial turf, and we hope that residents' concerns about potential dangers are taken into account. A less serious problem is the effect of falling on artificial turf. Professional ball players eased up on going after balls if it meant sliding on artificial turf, even describing it as feeling like falling on concrete. If that's the case for adult professionals, one can imagine how vulnerable kids are. As Kyla Bennett of Public Employees for Social Responsibility says, is artificial turf easier? Yeah, you don't have to mow it, but that doesn't mean it's right to use it. We encourage local parents and politicians to look seriously at the issue and act according to their strongest values.
National Grid, an energy company, is proposing a $3.8 billion hike for fossil fuels. Sane Energy Project and the No North Brooklyn Pipeline Group are asking us to tell Governor Hochul and Commissioner Christian to reject this anti-consumer plan. In 2022, an energy New York City and Long Island residents were slammed with a hike in utility rates by National Grid so they could expand their fracked gas system. And as recently as 2023, the company was back again demanding more money from customers to invest in fracked gas system with another rate hike that will increase everyone's bills by an average of $30 a month. National Grid's leaky, toxic gas system is harming New Yorkers and breaking our climate law. The gas system should be retired, not replaced. New York state law requires that we get off fossil fuels by 2050 to mitigate the climate disasters unfolding in the real time before us. Climate change is real, folks, with extreme heat, brutal cold, massive wildfires, devastating hurricanes, and previously unimaginable floods. The Public Service Commission, PSC, and the governor must ensure that we meet the requirements of the state climate law, protect our residents, farms, and businesses, and lead the nation in smart climate policy. What is best to invest in state and federal funds in the development of renewable energy systems and energy efficiency initiatives, including retrofit and electrification readiness programs to low-income New Yorkers. It is time to end the fossil fuel era, and it's time to retire National Grid's LNG facility, the Greenpoint Energy Center, a heart of the fracked gas system in New York City, and now focus on clean energy, renewable energy instead.
Two quick notes on right to repair. Oregon Senate passed a bill 25-5, truly a landslide. Next stop, the Oregon House. And California's wheelchair right to repair bill has gone into effect, giving users in that state the right to have their chairs repaired by independent repair shops.
We hear lots of talk about electric vehicles, which means batteries. There's the rub. Batteries right now mean lithium, which means mining. Much of the world's lithium comes from Argentina, where it lies under salt flats in areas where for generations people have harvested salt traditionally. Now, major international corporations are coming in to extract the lithium in the form of lithium carbonate, a process that uses vast sums of water. The United States has but a single active lithium mine in Nevada, and the U.S. government sees lithium as a national security issue, and it's pressuring the Argentinian government to vastly increase its production. This puts at risk constitutionally protected communities in the fragile arid ecosystem. Mari Arenque, an Argentinian from Salinas Flats who is involved with community organizing against lithium exploitation, tells The Progressive, "Our land has so much wealth, but we are losing it to those who come from the outside and fill their pockets." More information is on our website, ecoradio.org.
Here is Tom Chapin singing Locally Grown from his album Give Peas a Chance.
If I were an apple, I'd be very unhappy traveling 4,000 miles or more. From far off Tasmania in a shipping container to a shelf in a New Jersey store. Why should I be tortured when some New Jersey orchard would be totally thrilled to the core? To pick me and crate me and load me and freight me not 4,000 miles but four. An apple should be not far from the tree where it ripens in the fall. Locally grown and locally eaten is globally good, good, good for us all. If I were a berry, I expect I'd be very contrary and hardly inclined to get shipped out from Chile to a store in North Philly. Hey, I'd have to be out of my mind. It seems paradoxic and carbon dioxic that we force all our food to commute, wasting gallons of fuel, which we know isn't cool for people or planets or fruit. A
berry is fine, not far from its vine, near the farmer's market stall. Locally grown and locally eaten is globally good, good, good for us all. Of the fruit you might want to take home. Do not buy for your table till you check out the label and determine how far it did roam. Aside from the karma of helping the farmer who lives in your county or state, there is one more good reason to buy what's in season. The taste is incredibly great. So keep buying foods from regional dudes. Keep your carbon footprint small. Locally grown and locally eaten is globally good, good, good for us all. Good, good, good for us all.
That was Tom Chapin singing Locally Grown from his album Give Peas a Chance.
Now we welcome Brian Slolem from Slow Food USA. Please introduce yourself, Brian.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for having me on your show today. I'm Brian Slolem. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm the communications director for Slow Food USA, which is a national nonprofit that's advocating for good, clean, and fair food for all.
What do you mean by slow food?
Right. So slow food, the concept of, you know, slowness really emerged from an activist movement in the mid-1980s in Italy, of all places. We often think of Italy as having a rich and diverse culinary history. And in the 80s, a group of rebels thought that that was being threatened by the globalization of food systems, most notably by the arrival of a McDonald's in the Spanish Steps area in Rome. So right before this McDonald's was set to open in Rome in the 1980s, a man named Carlo Petrini gathered a bunch of his friends, and they staged a protest in front of the McDonald's, and they were shouting, "We don't want fast food, we want slow food." And they served people rich and delicious Italian cuisine, or so the lore goes. And from there, a movement was born to really turn away from the continued globalization and systemization of our food systems. And think more about indigenous and local practices, local producers, local farmers, and most importantly, to think about our role as consumers, or as we call it in the slow food parlance, co-producers, because we really need a consumer and we need a producer in order to make this whole system work. So the idea of slowness is to, take the industrialization back a couple of notches when we think of producing food, preparing food, and eating food. It's really about embracing the deliciousness of food, making sure that we're taking the time to appreciate the fruits and vegetables and meats that we're eating, and also helping to slow down the experience for farm workers who are often rushed to meet quotas and work harried numbers of hours. And so really, we just want to take a step back and reflect on where we're at in our global food system and turn it down a couple notches to really save the planet.
Like what Tom Chapin just sang about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've been reading Michael Pollan's book, Cooked, and he talks about the difference between corporate cooking and what we used to do at home, individual cooking, which has become optional for most, if not all of us. And what are we losing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, on a sort of emotional level, we're losing that the connection that we have to the people in our house. We're losing that connection to The sensory sensation of cooking, right? The feeling of the tomato as the knife slowly pierces the skin, the sound of the garlic heating up in the oil. Like we're losing that human, that like kind of, that visceral connection to food when we're awaiting the doorbell to ring when our DoorDash delivery arrives. And then of course, you know, thinking about the expenses and thinking about the various workers who may be mistreated in that system.
You're making cooking sexy.
Well, it should be sexy, right? We should be, yeah. You know, we should be turned on by food. We shouldn't be using food as this purely, you know, like ingredient in powering our bodies. We should be embracing the joy that food brings to us, and then also pursuing the justice that we need in our food ways. Yeah.
What do you mean justice?
Well, I think we can all acknowledge that, you know, particularly here in the U.S., our food system was built on the colonization of our continent from indigenous Native Americans, and then the system of enslavement that built our country on the backs of enslaved Africans. And we can never consider the system of food in the U.S. without recognizing the harms that have been done to people in this land. And so, you know, we know that injustice in food systems continue on from those legacies, for, you know, particularly as the recent USDA farm census released, our Black farmers in this country have continued to be in the decline because of systemic wrongs through credit access and so many other avenues of access for Black farmers to farmland. I think today, you know, from a peak of I think over 200,000 Black farmers existed in 1910. I'm sorry, 1 million Black farmers were working the land here in the U.S. in 1910. In 2022, only 41,807 Black farmers were actively working. That's a huge plummet in the number of Black farmers, and it's not because they're leaving the industry; it's because the industry left them. And so obviously,
that's a loss of over 950 people as the population has gotten higher.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
That number should have gone higher, not lower.
And admittedly, the same problem is happening to family farmers who are not, you know, who are of the dominant culture. The corporations are taking over them too, probably at a slower rate, but nonetheless.
Absolutely. Yes. The same survey that I just referred to, you know, really painted a bleak picture for small and mid-sized farms. And, you know, we see news that's not surprising, but continues to be troubling when it comes to smaller scale farms, which, you know, from an agroecological perspective and from a slow food perspective, we really need to lean harder and rely more on a small farm because, you know, a small farming practice may enhance our biodiversity in our mm-hmm. land, may lead to better ecological outcomes. And we all know how terrible a larger farm can be to our earth, to the people who are working on that farm or in that meat processing plant. And so, yeah, this is a troubling state we're in.
A few years ago, I was at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, and we went to the Wendy's headquarters to get them to join the Penny a Pound Coalition of Milwaukee Workers Fair Food Program, which they didn't, you know, but there's a lot of justice issues. So that was to give a penny a pound to for a fund to have decent working conditions for the migrant farmers who pick our tomatoes.
You know, and there's corporations buying up family farms, and they describe farming as low yield economy of yesterday.
And
does that make my blood boil? It's like low yield economy of yesterday. Where are you going to get your food from? You know, I guess they continue to want to get it from you know, China or wherever, and it's crazy. It's important economy of today.
Come on, let's throw it all in labs.
Oh, boy, does that make my blood boil.
Thinking about, you know, what it means to have monocropping, which is often an outcome of larger farms, you know, where they're growing just one single crop. We know that You know, not having diversity among crops can lead to horrible outbreaks of invasive diseases, which then can threaten the very access that we have to food. So we need to continue to fight for small farms that are diversifying their crops so that we can preserve the existence of food on this planet, quite frankly.
Well, you're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Ken Gale.
WBAI needs you. Our buddies keep us on the air, and it's easy. Just a few moments of your time right now lets us know that you care about the environmental news, information, and entertainment that Ecologic brings you each week.
Ecologic's BAI buddies are listeners who contribute regularly, month in and month out, so that we can be sure that there is enough money to pay our bills each month. It doesn't have to be much. $10 a month is just 33 cents a day, but more is really appreciated if you can. It really helps us. Call 212-209-2950 or go to give2wbai.org.
And if you want, you can send a check or money order directly for your membership and or premiums. Mail to WBAI Radio, Attention Membership, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, 11217. And now back to our guest, Brian Solem from Slow Food. Brian, when we talk about food issues, we've mentioned family farms and how they're under threat, but we haven't mentioned the farm bill, which goes through Congress every 5 years and affects small farmers, large farmers, food stamps. It mentions endangered species on farmland. It mentions so many things. Could you go into a little detail on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Farm Bill is one of the biggest omnibus bills that passes through Congress every 5 or 6 or maybe even 7 years this time. It really dictates who grows our food, how it's grown, and how it's distributed and accessed in our country. It's a major bill that was up for renewal back in 2013. Unfortunately, because of impasses in Congress, the Farm Bill was extended upon expiration in September to September 2024, which is this year, which really threatens some of the innovation and changes that we need to our food and farming practices. The further we kick the Farm Bill down the road, the longer we're prolonging improvements to programs like SNAP, which is the term we use for formerly known as food stamps, which provides access to food for millions of families across the country. Also, the Farm Bill, we really need it to enhance agroecological and practices that fight against climate change, because farmers are really feeling the brunt of climate change in a way that the rest of us are not. You know, many parts of the country yesterday had, big heat waves. Here at where I'm based in Chicago, we had like a 72 degree day. And that feels nice for us. But our farmers are really struggling with the effects of climate change. And so the Farm Bill, the fact that we're seeing these huge delays in the Farm Bill getting passed and some of the innovations that we need to see in the Farm Bill coming through for our farmers, for our food eaters and for our workers is really distressing.
The Center for Biodiversity talks about the Farm Bill affects species that live on farmland and live on land that's similar to farmland. Mm. And the of course, the agribusiness farms, they don't care about those birds and those butterflies. You know, they'll kill them all. We want the land.
Except the ones that pollinate, the bees. They want those, right?
Right.
It depends on who you ask, right?
I guess.
If they knew, if they understand science, then they do.
Right.
And local bee species that pollinate local crops, a lot of them have never been studied, so we don't know what they need. So if they plow over where they live, that's it. You know, you don't have local bees to pollinate your crops. And they won't know what happened. They just know something's wrong. And of course, as climate changes, farmers are farming based on the climate that they know. And as the climate changes, the way they farm has to change also. And the climate changes faster than they can adapt to it, because you have to adapt to it after it changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we at Slow Food USA connect with a number of small and mid-sized farms, and our friends here in Illinois at Janie's Mill, they described to me a little bit about what they needed to do to combat climate change. And frankly, it came down to going fully organic. They noticed that, you know, water was just running off of the surface of their fields in increasing number in recent years. And once they switched to an all-organic, low-till structure, they were able to see that impact mitigated. And so, you know, there is something to think about, you know, moving into the future. We maybe need to look back to the past and think about, you know, regenerative agriculture practices that were established by folks, you know, who are indigenous to this land, Native Americans, who really knew this land and understood how to till it, how to work with it. And, you know, for the health of small and mid-sized farmers, thinking about regenerative practices and thinking about agroecology, and, you know, the microbiomes of our farms, you know, right, really be the way that we can move forward in this troubling, you know, environmental climate we're in.
So to combat climate change, farmers are being healthier.
Exactly. But of course, making that transition away from industrialized farming to a more, you know, environmentally and ecologically friendly practice, that takes time and that takes money. And so, you know, that's where we need the support of the federal government. We need support around a bill like the Agricultural Resilience Act, which was introduced earlier this year, which makes sure that the food and farming system can move forward, and that we can change to a more eco-friendly farming process through crop insurance, organic farming transitions, farmland protection, pasture-based systems, and agrivoltaic systems. So we really need our partners at the federal government to help us preserve our food systems before it's too late. And so the bill is the Agriculture Resilience Act, and this was released at the spring of 2023. We consider this a marker bill, which is supposed to influence the outcome of the farm bill. We at Slow Food USA, we're following about 12 different food policy bills that are currently active in Congress that advance the rights of Black and beginning farmers, that support, you know, a more agroecological approach to farming, that support the rights of child nutrition access. And so, yeah, we're actively pursuing a number of bills and helping our 500,000 followers and our 3,000 members get on board and connect with their legislators about why it's so important to advance a slow food philosophy through federal act.
I know one of the things that we talked about on our last Farm Bill show back in October was the need for smaller grants rather than big, giant grants that only the corporations can use. Family farmers can use a smaller amount of money, and then you can spread it out to more small farmers.
Yeah, but it's more expensive for them to replace. It can really damage their entire economy to replace it. But Brian, can I ask you, what pushback, what obstacles do you get from any direction? Like somebody said to me, well, how are we going to produce a large amount of food for such a large population without factory farms? What pushbacks are you getting?
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest claims that we hear in opposition to a more local economy, a more small and mid-scale farm approach. And quite frankly, our factory farming system is not working. There are over a billion people on this earth who are going without food every single day. And so the system we have now is failing. So we need to try something new. We need to reverse the ill effects that our system is having on hunger, on health, on our planet, and on our personal connection to food. And so we need to dramatically change direction. We need to change course so that every human on this planet is able to access food, is able to be a food worker in healthy conditions, and is able to live on this planet for 7, 14, and 49 generations into the future.
Uh-huh. I remember seeing a movie at the United Nations. They interviewed a woman who had a little plot of land in Africa, and she fed her family of 10 on that land. And then the government comes in and says, no, you can't plant food. You have to plant these cash crops and make money, and then you buy the food. And right. She found out that the cash crops didn't make enough money to buy the food to feed the family that she had been feeding all along. So you have agribusiness influencing people all over the world like that.
Absolutely. It's a new wave of colonization of peoples, mm-hmm. of building an unfair, you know, dichotomy between the power of a corporation or the power of a government against the individual free will of people. And that's a sad example of pronounced example of the threat of a, you know, colonistic approach to food and to food production.
European farmers are fighting their governments on some of this, and we remember the wave of Indian farmer suicides. I mean, these corporations are just running roughshod over everybody. We need to fight back.
Absolutely.
What would you like listeners to do?
Well, first of all, listeners should be learning more about the Farm Bill, learning how they can advocate for a better food future. We need to reach out to our elected officials, our senators, our congresspeople, and talk to them about our concerns that are in standing in the way of good, clean, and fair food for all. So that's the big thing. I definitely encourage folks to follow Slow Food USA across social media channels. Check out our website to learn more about the future of food and farming in this planet. We have some action steps that folks can take that are right on our homepage in order to advance access to things like the Women and Infant and Children Food Program, which is currently $2 billion underfunded, as well as taking a look at some of our... Yeah, exactly. As an incredibly wealthy society, how do we feel comfortable acknowledging that a critical food access program is $2 billion underfunded? Like, where have we gone wrong to mistreat families in this country?
Well, gee, look at the military budget. I don't know.
yes, exactly. Why is that not on the table?
Right.
Something you said certainly makes me remember the wisdom of Indigenous people and Native Americans. What was the chief that talked about the we have to protect the world for seven generations? Mm-hmm. Indigenous people, Native Americans have definitely a healthier attitude towards the land and the food.
And their kids.
And life.
Absolutely. So the global slow food movement prioritizes the experiences and voices of Indigenous folks the world over. We have a group of Indigenous activists that are called Indigenous Terra Madre. They meet, they provide feedback and guidance to our global entities. They have a big conference coming up in Mexico City in a couple weeks.
What's the name of that group again?
It's Indigenous Terra Madre. So it's a program under the Slow Food umbrella that unites Indigenous folks across the world. And then here on North America, which in many Native American communities is called Turtle Island, we have a Slow Food Turtle Island Association, which is a confederation of Native American and Indigenous food producers who are aligned with the slow food movement and are working together to increase solidarity and resilience for Native American farmers and food producers. You can follow them on Facebook.
There's a lot of ways for people to become active and make the future of their own food better.
Absolutely.
And I suggest just go to your local farmer's market. Walk around and talk to folks and try something new.
Buy local.
Yeah. Absolutely. We think about buying local, something that really excites me and excites the slow food movement is this idea of local food procurement. When we think about our institutions like hospitals, schools, and prisons, they're buying food at huge scales, but unfortunately they're buying it very often from the same mega conglomerate food producers. Right. You know, your Aramarks, for example. There are some really amazing and innovative programs that are emerging at the state level in a number of states to have those systems buy not from big corporate food systems, but rather from smaller and mid-scale producers and farmers. So it's like, you know, your local school that your kids go to should be buying food from the farm that's 30 miles away, not from you know, the food system that's shipping food in from five states away. So that's happening at the state level in a number of states. And then most recently, a really cool bill was introduced a couple of months ago called the Effective Food Procurement Act, which basically inspires food procurement that is more local and more sustainable across all 50 states. So that's something Senator Richard Blumenthal co-sponsored recently from Connecticut. And it's a bill that we just think is really awesome.
Give us a name again.
Yeah, it's called the long name is the Enabling Farmer, Food Worker, Environmental and Climate Targets Through Innovative, Values Aligned and Equitable Food Procurement Act, which, like, as a communications professional, I would have been like, let's tweak that a little bit. Shortened, it's called the Effective Food Procurement Act. And I think, you know, leaning into this idea that, like, a more effective food system is really more like a food way, where we think about, you know, not like a bigger system, but a smaller person-to-person, farmer-to-school food way that makes our families healthier, helps our farmers thrive, and you know, reduces the power of big food.
The other cool thing I've seen is elementary schools with vegetable gardens, where they're teaching kids where food really comes from. It comes out of the ground sometimes. And, yeah.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the hallmark programs of Slow Food USA is a program called Plant a Seed. Every year we produce a kit of 6 to 8 varieties of rare, distinctive, and culturally significant foods that we send these seed kits to over 400 schools every year for free. And then we make them available for purchase for home gardeners as well. And throughout the year, we give folks tips on how to grow, harvest, and cook these different foods. This year, our kit is focusing on grains and roots, which is really cool. A lot of home farmer or home growers like me are a little intimidated by the idea of growing grains in our backyard. But this year, we're giving folks the tools to experience like a hullus purple karma barley. A really cool red fife wheat that are both beautiful as well as delicious.
That's a yummy action to take. We need more yummy actions.
Yes. We love a yummy action.
Yeah.
Yes. Can people get that, or is it only that you only have it? You know, can our listeners get it, or is it only for approval of groups that you give it to?
Absolutely. So for folks like me who are home gardeners, you can go to slowfoodusa.org and you'll see the Plant a Seed button right there at the top of the homepage. You can click that and pick up a kit for $39. It'll be sent to your house before Earth Day in 2024. And then you can plant those seeds right away and watch them thrive. Now, if you're at home and you're at work, I guess, today, and you're a school garden professional, maybe a school garden instructor or volunteer, you can get a kit absolutely free by emailing us at comms@slowfoodusa.org. It's comms at slowfoodusa.org. And we'll, just send us a little bit of information about your school garden and we'll send you a code for a free kit.
I was just thinking about when I was a kid, I worked for a convenience store, a national chain. I better not mention the name because maybe they've changed. But I was living in a rural area, and the manager of the store was not allowed to buy local produce. He wasn't allowed. And they sent him produce from over 1,000 miles away. And so he's putting out wilted produce for people to buy when not that far away was farmers selling produce that just came out of the ground. Yeah. And you kind of wonder what kind of attitude, where they were losing money by shipping the stuff and nobody buying it.
But they wouldn't prevent the manager
from making money for the store by buying local.
Yes. And unfortunately, this
corporate mindsets are weird.
So I assume that still goes on at these national chain stores.
Certainly. Who knows? But hopefully they'll see the light.
I don't know. It's I don't understand the attitude. But I do ecologic. I don't.
Well, they probably had a guarantee of a certain volume, and if the store didn't buy it, they wouldn't meet their contract and blah blah. But that's not the right mindset for a healthy environment, right. A healthy economy. That's
Well,
absolutely. That's prioritizing the
you're
dollar.
You're listening. Ecologic, WBAI is premier environment show right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Sally Gellert.
When you choose to become our Ecologic BAI buddy, you are giving us a reliable source of support that we can depend on, just as you can depend on WBAI. We're here for you all the time, and you'll be helping to ensure we stay here. Just $10 or $15 a month, more if you can, enables people to listen wherever they are, in our listening area and beyond, thanks to the internet, from people driving on I-95 to a nurse in Denmark, to people away from home who want to hear a familiar voice.
WBAI needs to reliably know that the bills will get paid. The best way to do that is to get more BAI buddy pledges. But any donations, anytime, helps us in a big way. Remember, tell them you're donating in the name of Ecologic. Just go to give2wbai.org. and put eco-logic in the search box to choose from our premiums, or call 212-209-2950 to make your donation today.
Now we'll take a couple of calls for Brian Solem at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. And while we're waiting, we want to let you know that applications are being accepted for some of New York City's community boards. Each of the 59 boards consists of up to 50 persons who live, work, study, or have other significant interests in the area covered by the board they wish to join. The boards are active from September to June. They influence such aspects of city life as the budget, schools, restaurants, cannabis shops, parks, zoning changes, and sanitation. Most, if not all, community boards have environmental committees. Applicants for two-year terms must be New York City residents over 16. Deadline for Bronx boards is March 1st. Staten Island boards is an open application process. See ecoradio.org for a link to detailed information.
You know, back in 1982, I was on my local board and talking about the possibility of uranium mining in the Catskills near New York City's water supply. One member worked for a Republican state senator. He was interested, gave me his phone number, and later told me that a town in Virginia had lost its entire water supply to uranium mining. He knew that with uranium mining in the Catskills, it could happen here, and got his boss to endorse a bill to ban uranium mining, though just for 10 years. Having a Republican sponsor got the bill passed. It all happened because of a conversation at a community board meeting.
Yeah, networking happens everywhere, and the community board is a really good place to make connections with people from your neighborhood and work on, you know, improvements that you really want to see.
And the number to call here is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. And tell us more about slow food versus fast food.
Yeah, sure. Actually, if you don't mind, I love this idea of people power and of us, you know, really having the power to change systems. And for Slow Food USA, we have 80 volunteer-led chapters across the U.S. that mm-hmm. folks can get involved with. Here in New York, we have a chapter on Long Island that does incredible programming across producers, and you know, they do some great baking programs. And then here we have Slow Food NYC. So it's really, you know, people taking the initiative and having these conversations about what needs to change, how they need to change it, creating space for conversations between food producers and consumers, and, you know, really, yeah, taking power back as individuals to make a better food future.
And there's a North Jersey chapter as well.
There is, yeah.
And we have a caller, 212-209-2877, and you are on the air.
Hi, how are you? This is Ethel from the Bronx. I love your show, Ecologic Family. And I like that idea where the gentleman, I didn't catch his name, was talking about the food packet that you can purchase. And I'm going to let some schools know about it. And it's so important because I understand that there's a lot going on with our gardens and farmland that's being brought up by corporate America. And that's not good, because you don't know what you're eating. You know, there should be a way to detect your food. And if you do have farmland, there should be a way for you to protect it if you're doing it outside. Some type of canopy, something that can protect it. But we all know we need sunlight. And you're also hearing about them also trying to block the sunlight, which doesn't make sense. So
we're going to do a lot about that in a future show.
Thank you.
Now, but Brian, we can't mention the price, but how many seeds do you get in that seed packet? How much land would that cover? How big a garden do you have to have?
I mean, it would cover a pretty big home backyard. It's a sizable number of seeds per plant. And this year we have 7 different plants. You could really go to town. I would encourage folks, if they pick up a plant a seed kit for their home garden, to perhaps consider looking up a local seed library. A lot of communities have seed libraries where you can exchange seeds with other folks in the community. So, you know, maybe if you don't want to grow 50,000 Wisconsin purple carrots, maybe you donate some seeds to your local seed library and let somebody else explore gardening as well.
And then your next door neighbor
get together with some neighbors and buy a packet to share amongst yourselves.
I love that. And certainly, you know, seeds don't expire, you know, the year that you get them. So, you know, depending on the crop, some seeds can last up to 5 years after harvesting. So, yeah, consider saving some for the future, or, you know, doing some seed saving practices with the seeds that are produced in the crops you grow this year.
You mentioned a seed library. Is that a common thing? Can you find seed libraries places? And if not, let's get some people to start them up.
Absolutely. In recent years, more actual like brick and mortar book libraries have become de facto resources for seed libraries too, because they're climate controlled buildings. They already share the name and the commitment to preservation and distribution of knowledge and resources. So you might want to ask your local library if they have a seed library. And if not, hop on the old World Wide Web, ask Google if there's a seed library near you. But certainly in the New York City area, you all have to have a bunch of seed libraries that are teeming with seeds.
Wow. It's amazing what is going on. Mm-hmm. I am so glad that we have the opportunity on WBAI to let people know about these great things that are going on. I mean, you know, seed libraries and seeds for schools and stuff. What a wonderful thing that has been going on. I suspect some people didn't know. I didn't know I had a seed library in New York City.
The Experimental Farm Network down in Salem County with its co-op gardens connection. I went to a seed exchange down in I think Collingswood or somewhere down there. There's lots happening all over.
Absolutely. Yeah, our Slow Food New York City chapter actually maintains a community garden in East New York called Ujima Garden that you can Stop by whenever you want. They're always looking for volunteers to help them, you know, get your fingers in the soil, do some tilling or weeding. And then all that comes out of the garden is distributed among community centers in the area. So that's just, you know, one example of something happening close by for your listeners.
East New Yorkers in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And in New York City, there are community gardens. We've had there are a number of them, and we've had them speak on the show. We also have what's Paul Prestonju's organization? He has a garden set up in Westchester. Oh, right. Dear.
Yes.
sorry, Paul. All right.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot. I mean, people are not as healthy. It's not as nutritious. And, you know, they know they want their kids to have nutritious food. So, you know, if it takes slow food to do it, then that's what we do. If it takes a community garden, that's what we do.
Yeah, I'm thinking of things like, you know, I shouldn't mention a commercial name, but the groups that send you a kit of things with a recipe so that you can cook your own food. So you don't have to deal with the shopping and so forth. It comes to your door. It's a little bit crazy upscale, but, you know, it's an indication that people want to connect to the food.
Absolutely. Yeah, and or popping over to your farmer's market and asking your local farmer what's fresh and what can I cook with the things I see in front of me? I've never seen that green before. What is it? What does it taste like? And how should I prepare it? You know, that kind of person-to-person connection is really, you know, a beautiful and simple way to combat, the globalization of food systems.
In New York City, the green markets have a rule that somebody from the farm has to be at the table.
Excellent.
So you have somebody to ask these questions to. It's wonderful. And they love answering them. I've never had anybody going, oh, get away, I'm busy. I've never had that experience.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for this information. But it is time to wrap up, everybody. So thanks for joining us. For more information, go to www.slowfoodusa, the slow-foodusa.org. Ecoradio.org has information on a wide variety of environmental issues, and you can find I see. There's no dash in there. Is that what you're saying, Sally?
Yep.
EcoRadio has information on a wide variety of environmental issues, and you can find links to our previous shows as well. If you'd like a follow-up or a news report on any of our previous shows or news items, email us using the clickable link near the top of the page, just under the promo meme, and please go to give2wbi.org to become a BAI buddy in the name of Ecologic, or choose a premium. Join us in 2 weeks on March 13th for a celebration of nature, turtles, and tortoises. Ken?
And also, there's other food shows that we've done on Ecologic. So while you're in that mood, go and click on those. You can listen to those from our website, ecoradio.org. And we'd love to stay in touch with you. So those of you online, please sign up for our email list while you're checking out ecoradio.org. Those of you on Facebook, please like our page. We're at WBAI Ecologic, no dashes.
There are lots of ways to get involved at WBAI. Check the meeting section of the WBAI.org homepage for dates and times. And, of course, we always need your donations. There's a lot happening at WBAI, and it takes resources. Equipment needs maintenance, our small staff needs to be paid, and premiums need to be mailed. Pledging as a BAI buddy now, during this show, really helps Ecologic especially.
We are always glad to have you with us for Ecologic, live or on the archives. This show will be on WBAI archives in just 5 or 10 minutes.
Our thanks to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins. We couldn't do this without you. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Join us in 2 weeks on Wednesday, March 13th at 10 a.m. for Turtles and Tortoises. We're usually here Wednesdays at 10 a.m. between Covert Action Bulletin and Living for the City. Check our website for details. Thanks for being our listeners.
See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
Slow. intensive energy. So
Sergeant, with this day in racial injustice. On this day, February 28th, 1942, white mobs rioted against racial integration in Detroit. As black families attempted to move into their new homes, they were met with violence and intimidation and denied entry to their homes. Before and during World War II, the city of Detroit, Michigan was a hub for economic activity that attracted a large influx of new residents. Many newcomers were African Americans fleeing racial violence and inequality in the rural South in a wave known as the Great Migration. Those who resettled in Detroit felt the city offered new opportunities for economic mobility, but housing was a problem. New construction did not keep up with the pace of the increasing population, and the residential segregation created dangerous slums. Black families were banned from most public housing, restricted to overcrowded neighborhoods, and often forced to pay higher rents to live in dilapidated homes without indoor plumbing. They also faced hostility from the local Ku Klux Klan, police, and groups of white workers. In June 1941, Detroit policymakers approved plans to build the Sojourner Truth Homes, a public housing project for African Americans located in a white neighborhood. Over protests from local white people, construction was completed that year, and the city authorized black families to move in starting February 28th, 1942. One day before, growing crowds of local white people marched through the housing project. On move-in day, only a few black families braved the harassment and intimidation. Some were struck with rocks. Police responded only by halting the moves and arresting more than 200 black people and only 3 white individuals. The new residents were displaced until April, when 6 black families moved in under the protection of 2,000 city and state officials. This has been This Day, February 28th, in Racial Injustice, from the Equal Rights Initiative, and this is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Joy of Resistance. We're sisters of the
joy. Do one-celled, fertilized eggs have the same rights as full-grown persons under the law? An Alabama court recently decided that they do, potentially allowing murder charges to be brought against anyone destroying a fertilized egg. Now, Republican candidates are in panic mode trying to distance themselves from this unpopular decision by their own right-wing judges. On Thursday, February 29th at 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance will speak with attorney Jessica Mason Pieglo about the meaning of this decision and the storm that has followed it. Then we'll speak with Candace McDuffie, journalist and author of the recent article, Fannie Willis Testimony Proves That Black Women Don't Go Down Without a Fight, about the racist, sexist attacks currently being launched at D.A. Willis as she prosecutes Donald Trump for election.